Hello, finally.
It's been a bit of a break.
Yeah, it certainly has. It's such a pain in the ass here. Every day I look out the window and I think, ah, surely the builders are going to be moving up a little bit now and sort of get out of earshot. And then I think it was last week they decided to get a pneumatic drill and start digging up the curb, ready to start tarmacking the pavements. And then yesterday they came back and started actually tarmacking the pavement, and I was like, oh, thank God, it'll be all done, so it'll be nice and quiet tomorrow. And then they only did one side of the road, and it wasn't my side. And I'm like, oh God, if they come back tomorrow, it's gonna pain. They were really chavvy as well, like really loud and annoying. Like literally, I had all my windows shut, and you could still go, yeah, pour that gravel over there, mate. I'm like, oh, fucking shut the fuck up.
And was it the typical four of them standing around and one of them actually doing the work?
Oh,
Three,
yeah.
two of them watching, two of them talking, one having a fag, you know?
It was funny because they were trying to talk to the guy who's tarmacking and he's got headphones on and a big. And they're shouting, hey, mate, we're going down Mackie D's. What do you want? What? What do you want? You want a Charlie Milkshake,
Yeah, they get there, set up, sort of 10 minutes in, and then off for breakfast.
Yeah, it was
The usual.
annoying.
Yeah,
But.
I haven't had the same haven't had the same here. I have had some work done on the TARDIS, on TARDIS loo, because it was in a bad state. So basically, when it rains, what was happening was water was getting in just gradually, and it was creating like seams in the wood. And then what would happen is, so you'd go out and check, and it's all fine, dry. And then next day, more rain. Go out, check, it's fine. Third day, go out, an inch of water in the bottom. Because the water's finally found its way through, and then any drops now just go straight through. And basically, yeah, he came around. There was a local guy I found on that next door. I started that next door community, and it's actually worked out amazingly here. I've got rid of like patio slabs. Just people came and took like hundreds of patio slabs, and people helping each other out on different things. And this guy I found locally, so he's down in the town, and he basically came out. He's like a jack of all trades, carpenter type. So does bits of everything, but he's good at the carpentry. And he just took the roof off. It was terrible in the top. It was all the felt wasn't sealed and everything. So he completely redid the roof in terms of covering it, so that there's literally no gap. The whole thing's got two layers of felt. It's got this like a plastic flashing type, but it feels like metal, soft like metal, but it's almost like a plastic. So that won't, you know, it just won't. It can't get in, basically. It's just impossible. And then on the inside, he took the internal ceiling down, and he found 10 slugs. 10 slugs in the ceiling space. I mean, apparently they can squeeze through tiny spaces, and just horrible black mold. So that's and it was wet and damp. So that's all been fixed and sorted. And now what I've got now is a hatch. It's got like a little hatch with the light on, so that I can just bring it down. Get access to that. I mean, it's only a tiny space. It's like you know, centimeter, 2 centimeters. So you can't exactly get in there. But what you can do now is I can work. If the light goes wrong, I can do stuff without having to sort of stand looking up at the ceiling. So that's brilliant. So yeah, I know what you mean.
Nice. I feel I'd be remiss if I didn't make a water always wins joke from a Doctor Who.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So it's costing me a bit
Could be
more money,
worse.
and it's the money pit of outside accessories. But hopefully, finally, this is it for several years. It's not going to need it again because it's just been fairly horrendous.
Speaking of money pits, that sounds like a nice segue into the most expensive Lego set we're probably ever going to buy.
Oh my God, yes. I mean, you know, I think we talked about it before, about saying, you know, it's possible they might re-release it or something, and it's pretty inevitable that they're going to, you know, because if you look at other sets they've done where they've done like updates and refreshes, I remember there was that the first sort of Red 5 UCS X-Wing, which I missed out on, but I've got now. I bought a more expensive from eBay, but a boxed version, but I've managed to grab one. But I missed that the first time around, and then when the second X-Wing came out, I missed that as well. You know, they've done those refreshes before, but it's going to be
So
interesting to see
Star
what they
Destroyers,
do.
there's a ton of Star
Yes,
Destroyers.
exactly. But it was like the Millennium Falcon just seemed to be, and I think we talked about it because we were talking about the Leppin stuff, and how, you know, there's a massive. I mean, if you go on eBay and look up UCS Millennium Falcon, 90% of the sets that come back are in sort of £300-400 range. They're the Leppin sets. They're not even the Lego sets. So even the Leppin sets, even the knockoff set, is expensive in the secondhand market and has got its own mini economy going on. It's insane. You know, I spent about, I think it was about 700 quid on the BrickLink version, which I haven't built yet because I can't bring myself to spend 30 hours. And if I'm going to do that, I'm probably going to do it on the official one. Well, I'll never be able to do it in one sitting, so it'll end up sitting around. It's the danger of, I mean, I've seen those time-lapse. Have you seen the time-lapse videos of the guys building it where they, I mean, they do it so well. They've literally got all the boxes. They've got all these little boxes of bricks. They've literally put all the different types of bricks everywhere. And it's almost like they're sitting down for a session. You know, this is it. We're going to do this. And it's time-lapsed and it's amazing. It's really cool.
I suppose the original Millennium Falcons were done before the time when they started putting them all in numbered bags. I don't know when they started doing that because that makes it a lot easier.
Yes, definitely.
I did the Superstar Destroyer, which was about 3,500 pieces, and that took, let's say, about 14 hours or so. But that was all right because at least it came in that you just, you know, open all the bag one, and then what I'd usually do is maybe do two or three bags and then stop and then come back to it.
Yeah.
But if you just had the entire box and it's just, here's all the pieces, have fun. Like it used to be, that's a pain.
Was that the biggest set then? Was that the biggest, in terms of number of bricks?
No, the biggest one, the biggest Lego set ever, I believe, is the Taj Mahal, which is somewhere around 5,700 pieces.
But is it a physically big set, or is it just lots of tiny pieces?
Oh, sorry. No, it's huge. It's like 4.5 foot long.
Okay.
And it weighs, I want to say, eight pounds?
Because I'm trying to work out what, you know, this Falcon, which we pretty much established that's what it is from what's being
It's definitely
posted around. Falcon. It's 6,000 pieces?
Well, all they've said is it's going to be the largest Star Wars set yet. And the previous largest Star Wars set was a Millennium Falcon, which was around 5,200 pieces, I think.
Oh, okay. So
the
estimate
is it's probably going to be around 5,500 to 6,000 pieces.
Because there's lots of little pieces in it, isn't there, as well? There's lots of...
There'll be all the greebling on the top, which tends to be where most of the part count goes. That was certainly the case with the Superstar Destroyer, because that's mainly little, you know, one-brick studs that just cover everything to make it look more textured. So I imagine that's a huge part of it.
Yeah. I'm hoping the, because did you see, I think it was last year, or there was a guy on Flickr who posted some stuff about a Millennium Falcon build he'd done, which was incredibly accurate in Lego. I mean, it was astonishingly accurate. You know, the cockpit was amazing. I think he'd even done the internals. That was the cool thing. So you could take the roof off and you had all the internals. But the size, compared to the Lego figures, it was size correct.
Everything, that's good.
Portion. It was really, really, really amazing to look at.
That's what annoys me about so many of these interior things. Like the Superstar Destroyer has a small interior. So it has like the bit from The Empire Strikes Back where the bounty hunters are all stood around, like that pit bit. And it has that, but obviously to scale, it would mean that Darth Vader is about twice the size of a regular Star Destroyer. Because the little bit that they've got for the middle of it is sort of mini scale size. It irritates me. I mean, luckily you just cover it up so you don't see it. But it's like the Death Star. I never like the Death Stars because they're just open and they've just got all the different rooms. And it's like I would rather have those as little cube vignettes that you can, you know, put around the place like the Big Bang Theory set rather than having it in this big spherical thing, which then doesn't look like a Death Star at all.
Yeah, because actually, I know it's different for us because we're building it as sort of collectors, if you like. But if you're a kid and you want to play with this stuff, that's how I'd imagine playing with it. You know, you'd have your sort of big thing that's your vehicle that you're playing with and flying or whatever. And then if you want to do the sort of playing around with the characters, it'll be better to play with them in those little vignette type things. Because that would be it'd be much more fun. But I'm wondering whether the count could as well. Oh, wow. I mean, doesn't sound like it's hugely different from the old Millennium Falcon, but it would be cool if they did the interior. I guess structurally wise, it's difficult to.
I think that would be very, very. I mean, it'll probably have a cockpit, I would think, and maybe have like the little, I don't know what you call it, a little bar area, like the middle bit where they play.
Holochess.
Pazak. That's not right. Holochess, yeah, that's the one. Pazak's a game from Knights of the Old Republic.
Yeah.
I don't know where that suddenly jumped out of my memory. but it was a good game, actually, as well. But yeah, I doubt they're going to get much. I mean, I think it's going to be just slightly larger or pretty much the same as the old one, but with tweaks, because it'll be the Episode 8 Millennium Falcon or Episode 7 Millennium Falcon. And so it might be slightly different in places.
And maybe, you know, maybe, I mean, I would imagine the simplest thing to do is just literally do the Episode 8 one, but I wonder whether they would do a throwback sort of thing of saying, you know, here's the Episode 8 one, but if you want the Episode 5 dish, you know, the original, here's the bits for that, you know, in a separate bag almost. So you could do that if you wanted to, but...
Yeah, that might happen. And that would explain, again, you know, an increased part count, because there might be, you know, 20, 30 pieces that you...
Yeah, because I...
Or they're just stuck in a load more characters. There's probably like two extra pieces, and that's because they've added BB-8.
Yeah. The Bricklink scent I bought was obviously the original, based on the original UCS one with the normal dish. And so what I ended up doing was, there was a guy on eBay selling a pre-made episode seven dish. So I've actually got that dish built because it came complete. So that sort of sits on top of my Airport Extreme. I've got it's like Deadpool or something. I've got the dish and I'm trying to grow the rest of the thing around it. You know, it's the only thing left. Yeah, just sitting there looking at me, saying, "Build the rest of me, please." Reminds me of Deadpool. And I was watching the other day Fifth Element. You know, when they find the hand.
Oh, God, yeah.
And then they rebuild her from the hand. That's quite
cool. That's a weird film.
It is a great film, though, but it is a weird film. Very weird.
Yeah.
My understanding is that new one, I haven't seen it yet, Valerian, hasn't been hugely successful.
No, my wife wants to go and see it, and I'm just like, I really don't want to. And then we're going. It's her dad's birthday this weekend, so we're going to go and see Dunkirk at the IMAX, which was, it's like 18 quid a person. It's fucking crazy. But,
oh, it's insane, yeah.
I was like, oh, I don't want to go and see Dunkirk either, really. I want to go and see The Hitman's Bodyguard with Ryan Reynolds and Samuel L. Jackson. It's much better.
Well, taking kids to the cinema now, I mean, when you go with a family, I mean, if my wife goes during the holidays, she'll go with our kids, plus she might take a couple of the cousins, or, you know, three or four of the cousins. So you're talking about potentially sort of seven, eight kids, which, even if it's 10 quid each, you know, that's 80 quid, then your ticket. Then it's like, by the time if you had popcorn and drinks, you could easily spend over 100 quid to see a film.
It's crazy. And people wonder why they pirate films.
I know. And then you go and do that, and then I go and buy it when it comes out on iTunes.
Well, we've got the Cineworld membership cards that we've had for like 3 years, which are costing us a fortune. I don't know why we do, because we don't go to the cinema that much. So that gives us free entry all the time to like as many films as you want. But if you go to the IMAX... you have to pay an extra, it was like £4.70 or something. So with our two and her dad's, it worked out as like 26 quid. And I was like, I used to pay less than that to buy full tickets to go to the cinema for three people or five people even. That's crazy. But we just do just sound like old men now.
I know. And also,
back in my day,
we've done another good segue into the Rock movie.
Oh.
In air quotes.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I can see why they did it that way, because it got a lot of publicity the day before it launched, because everyone was like, what? What do you mean you've done
a Siri movie?
And like people already slating it, going like, well, it'll obviously be Apple's no good at original content. I don't see how they could make it. I mean, look how shit the trailer poster looks. It's like, oh, jeez.
I know.
It was Take everything so seriously.
I know. If you couldn't see that seriously, yeah, good joke. if you could sort of, yeah, when it came up and it was like Apple are doing a movie, and my immediate thought was, that's not possible. That's just doesn't sound right.
And then literally about it later, now.
We see the real thing. I thought it was really good.
I loved it. I thought it was really, really funny. it was the bit when he's just turns up at the airport, and then it cuts and you just see him sat in the pilot's seat with a little hat on. And he's like, welcome aboard this newly chartered flight to Rome. Yeah. So we're not going to Rome, we're going to Rome.
Yeah, that was great. We're going to Rome.
Oh, that was great. Yeah, it was a little fashion show.
Earth, wind, fire,
I mean, rock.
It was just well done. I mean, I'd love to know how much it cost. It must have cost an absolute fortune, but it was very, very well done. I liked it.
Yeah, it is funny because he is, I think he's, is he the most highest paid Hollywood actor this last year or something, just because he's been in like so many films. He's been something like something stupid like 15 or 20 in this year. And so he is an incredibly busy man, and he must be an incredibly expensive man to hire. So to get him to do something like that. But I can imagine, he seems like a genuinely nice person. Like, he doesn't, like, I would imagine what you see is pretty much how he's like off stage. And I can imagine him looking at something like that and be like, well, this just sounds like fun. I'll do it just because it's fun.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, it seems like him and Chris Pratt at the moment basically are in most films.
Yeah.
And both just look the same in all the films they do. You know, The Rock has a certain look, and Chris Pratt usually just has like a weird little sort of half beard and basically Star-Lord in every other film.
Yeah, yeah.
When I saw Jurassic World, it was like, were they filming these two simultaneously? It's basically the same character in a different outfit.
The new Jurassic World, I'm looking forward to that. It's coming out next year. It's got Dr. Malcolm in it, which will be exciting. A bit of Jeff Goldblum.
Oh, Jeff Goldblum's always good. I mean, what did they... Because they did you had the original Jurassic Park, then it was Lost World, which had Goldblum, wasn't it?
Which was just him. And then the third one was just
Alan Grant.
Alan Grant, that's it. Neil.
Yeah.
It's because he's called Sam O'Neill, that's where I got it from.
That was also good. I like that as well.
It was all right. I liked the story of it, but I didn't like the kid that was like, we've lost him on an island. And then he's like gone all rogue, and he's just like sat wiping T-Rex shit on himself, and he's like, yeah, I can hide from the dinosaurs, I'm not scared of them. And it's just like,
he's suddenly an expert. But I think they do that though, don't they, with some of these films. It's like, we've got to have a kid in there, we've got to have the sort of everyday character, and we've got to appeal to us, you know, the audience. And you think, well, I wouldn't really want my... I mean, I think my kids have seen... I think Leo at least has started watching Jurassic World. And it's like, please don't watch that. God. I mean, it's not that bad. It's not that bad. I mean, it's not... You know, when you see stuff... When you see people being grabbed or eaten, they're sort of just being taken away type thing. But... I think it's a bit
different. The second one... Like, I liked the second one because I liked Jeff Goldblum. But, again, the kid in that was just so irritating. And she was like... That they'd always try and get in, like, oh, she's good at gymnastics. She's good at gymnastics.
God,
and
then
at the end, she like escapes some velociraptors, and she's just like twirling around all these poles in a barn. And the editing is really bad because you could see like these rusty pipes that she's supposed to be swinging off, but there's actually a gymnast bar, and like you can see it vibrating behind. So you can just see it dropping down, and it's blatantly not her. Like, she looks completely different. Like, the stunt actor awful. Just awful.
Yeah, that was funny how they... I love that in those films where they slip that stuff in. Yeah, she's... By the way, did I say she's good at gymnastics? And it's like, this building something.
Yeah, I watched a documentary about the Bond film, The World Is Not Enough. And I don't know if you remember
that
one, but it's the one with...
Pierce Brosnan?
Pierce Brosnan, and the villain was Robert Carlyle as the guy that couldn't feel pain. He had like a bullet lodged in his brain, couldn't feel pain. And there was Electra King was the love interest. Well, I suppose Denise Reed.
Yes.
In any case, there's a scene where they are at a caviar factory, and it gets like these big helicopters come in that have got like saws like coming right down through from the bottom of them. And they like cut through the buildings and cut through the car and stuff, and it's pretty cool. And when I watched the documentary of that, there's one bit as he drives into like a completely different part of the film earlier on, like at the oil field, and it shows one of those helicopters cutting trees, because that's what they're for. They're like tree-cutting ones. And the director was like, oh yeah, we put this in so that you could see this helicopter in a real-use setting and not think much about it. And then when it comes later, you're not like, well, why have they got these helicopters with saws hanging off the bottom of them? That's a bit weird. So it's like we just sort of slightly nudge that this is a thing in the world that you might see later, but without being blatant, like, oh, she does gymnastics. Like, if she just turned up and, you know, in gym outfit or something, it'd be fine. But, I'm being nitpicky.
That's quite cool. Yeah, I remember that scene because they cut through a Z8. I think it's a BMW Z8.
I think it was probably a Z5.
The Z5.
An early one. This little tiddly one. It just cuts through it, and you see him jump out the side of it, and then it just goes, poof, and that he just splits in half, and like the
yeah.
the alarm's going off still as it's yes. split in two, and the headlights are flashing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it suddenly makes like that strangled boo.
Yeah, it's got really good electrics. sort of keeps working while it's cut in half.
Yeah.
Oh dear.
Oh. But anyway, I suppose the main thing we should discuss really is what can only be described as a horrific cock up.
Yeah.
Of the HomePod firmware.
I mean,
it's so bad. I mean, it's not even everyone sort of focused on the, you know, that single little glyph which shows the exact shape of the iPhone 8
yeah.
or iPhone Pro that everyone knew anyway because leaked multiple times by that point. But then there's tons of information in there, like an Apple Watch with a SIM card. And an Apple TV that's got a 4K resolution and stuff like that.
Yeah.
There's so much stuff in that just keeps coming out. Every day there's something else that comes out of it. It's like, good, that's another secret ruined.
I know, and it's really, I mean, there's sort of a dual, I've got a dual feeling about it really, because it's like, it's really, I mean, I can't believe what would be going on internally there, but it's really sort of frustrating in a way that there's all this work that's been done to keep everything secret and to keep everything or what, you know, you get supply chain leaks and everything else, but, you know, they've done a good job in terms of hiding most stuff, or a lot of stuff. And then one little thing, and it's like everything. It's not even just we've got the screen icon. It's not even that we've got Face ID. You know, it's everything. And it's yeah. and the worst thing is, it's not even iPhone 8 firmware. You know, it's firmware for a completely different device or an operating system for a completely different device. That should have had all this stuff. You know, there's even stuff in there that says hide or remove that they obviously should run some filtering through to get rid of all this stuff. It's just, it must be so frustrating. And a part of me is, you know, it's cool to know this stuff. It's a bit like, you know, I do that thing, which I shouldn't do because it's stupid, of when I, you know, read about new films and stuff, I might go to Wikipedia and end up reading the plot. and so I sort of know. And, you know, I haven't done it for a lot of films recently, but there's certain films that I have. I mean, I didn't, you know, Spider-Man Homecoming, I didn't read it. So it was quite good, cool watching that, but I have in the past. So it's a bit like that where, you know, you suddenly know all this stuff that's going to happen, but you can still go and see the film and enjoy the film, you know, even though it's almost like that stuff's forgotten when I'm seeing the film. So it's nice to know some of this stuff, but I almost feel like you're ruining it for everyone. You're just... You know, I'm hoping there's still going to be something. I'm hoping there's still going to be something they talk about. I'm sure, you know, when the event happens, the event will be enjoyable anyway. You know, it's like that same sort of concept. Even though it's been effectively spoilt, it's still going to be an enjoyable event to see the reveal and see all the real product and everything else. And it's going to feel a lot. It was like when the iPhone 4 got leaked, you know, when it got left in the bar or whatever. Yeah, we all saw it. We all saw it. We saw the shape of it. We saw everything. We knew the screen was Retina, everything else. But when you actually saw it and when you got one in your hand, it was completely, you know, completely different.
That's
experience.
One of my favorite Steve Jobs moments is actually he sort of shows it and he's like, here it is from the size. Just goes, you might have seen this somewhere before. And everyone starts laughing. And he just turns around and goes, I can tell you, you've not seen it.
Exactly.
And then he goes into his pitch. And that was really good.
Exactly. And I think one of the things with this, and one of the things that fascinates me with the screen is... I don't think some of the renders that we've seen in terms of the way they've shown the bezels or the bezels, however you say it, with black and white fronts, specifically the lighter ones, I don't think that's how it's going to look. And the only reason I say that is I know that we've got this tradition of white phones and black phones, which have, you know, the silver back, light silver, and you have the white front, everything. But if you think about, and we're probably going to get into the detail of it now, but you know this horn screen or notch screen that they're talking about, which has got these two little horns, two notches at the top, and the little dip just at the top for the cameras and stuff. The rumor and the theory around this is that if it's black, and because the screen is going to be OLED, then it can do a deeper black, and therefore you could hide that status bar with that or that notch by having a bar across the top, and then you have your little carrier icons or whatever in the two notches and the battery in the other notch or whatever.
That works,
but that would mean the front has to be black because you can't do it otherwise. You can't have that seamlessness unless you have this craziness of having the bezels white and that notch black, which doesn't make any sense. So for me, it almost, and also just the look with the bezels white and the notch white, you know, that because they're doing these mock-ups in sort of silver or whatever and showing the sort of light front. And I just think it looks awful. So I'm wondering whether we're going to end up with a black, you know, we're going to end up with this air quote bezel-less display by making the whole front black. And what and you can have whatever back color you want. So the concept of having a white front will be gone. That's what I think.
I would expect that that would be the case. I mean, to be honest, we don't know how thick the bezels are.
Like,
the icon, I remember you on Twitter saying, well, it's not bezel-less. Look at the icon. And it's like, well, the icon doesn't... I mean, obviously, an icon for a bezel-less phone still has to have a border around it because otherwise...
And it has to be thick.
It's not an icon.
It's going to be shrunk down.
Yeah, so we don't know how thick, whether those bezels are truly bezel-less, where it's just, you know, they round, go round the side of the phone, and the bezel is actually just the black bar of the UI, or whether there is actually a bezel and it's just, you know, imperceptibly small because it's like a couple millimetres or something.
Yeah.
In which case, I would agree that it's probably going to be a black front. I don't see how you would do it otherwise with an OLED screen, because that's kind of the point of it, and change the color on the back, as you say. But the other thing is, they could just say, you know, fuck it, there's one color, it's black.
Exactly.
This is the Pro model. And, you know, historically, when Apple releases a Pro item for the first time, it's available in one color and it's always black. Like the iMac Pro is slate gray. When they release, like, you remember the old MacBooks, like the really old ones, where they were all like white plastic, but then the expensive one was black, and that was the only way to get the black model was to pay more. That sounds like something they would do for a phone that costs a lot more. It's like, it's one color. Because the reason for having multiple colors is so that you can tell people you've got the new phone. Like, that's why they add gold, because now you've got your iPhone, you can see it, and it's gold one, that must be the new one. And then the 6S, oh, it's rose gold, that must be the new one. Because otherwise you can't tell the difference that easily. With this, I mean, it's going to be obvious that it's the new one, so they don't need to worry about colours. I mean, to be honest, I think the colour thing has become less important because most people have cases anyway. Mm. Like, the actual colour of the back really doesn't matter. Like, I mean, how often do you look at the back? You don't.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, I normally just get whichever one's quickest to arrive.
Yes.
I'd have a rose gold one if that was the only option. I really don't care. It's going to be in a brown leather case anyway, so it makes no difference. But the front's interesting because, I mean, there was a debate with the iPad. I really liked the white one, but a lot of people said that it's better to get the black because when you're watching a film, because the aspect ratio is 4:3 and you're going to be watching something in 16:9 or 16:10, you're going to have black bars top and bottom. And if you have the white iPad, it's really obvious that you're watching a screen that's constrained because you've got this big white border as well as the black ones. Whereas if you have the black one, it disappears a little bit more. And that's pretty much what's going to happen with this if they try and have a white front. I think it'd look a bit weird.
Yeah, I mean, and if they are doing this sort of hidden notch by using the status bar, it's just completely cocked up with the white. So that would make perfect sense for it to be black. The other thing is, So the other two things are the mock-ups that we end up seeing is almost like they take that icon, scale the icon up, which then has overly sized bezels, because if it didn't, when they shrunk down the icon, you wouldn't be able to see them. And then they're sort of mocking that up as a real phone, which just then looks ridiculous. But the interesting thing was about, so this thing about the sort of hidden status bar, if you like, I think has two things. One is I think it looks nicer just to have the hidden, to have that black at the top, so you get a nice straight top and you don't have the notch. The second thing is, how do you use that notch with apps? Because yes, you could potentially put stuff up there, but how's that, you know, people were talking about having, you know, next back buttons and things like that up there, but you know, not all apps
use too small.
Not all apps use just an arrow or use just the back. They have, you know, typically if you're in a screen that has a window title and you go to a subscreen, it the back button will share that with that title, won't it? So It's just not enough space. It's just not enough space. So there's two things. One is that, and then John Gruber mentioned this, which was really interesting. He said, well, you know, there has to be a reason why that icon has been used so that you can identify this phone. Therefore, those notches at some point in using the phone must be visible. Otherwise, you're not identifying that phone. So if they're hidden all the time, you're never seeing the notch. Yeah, you're never seeing the notch, and therefore there's no quick way, other than saying, oh, your screen's really big, of identifying that that's your phone. So what he's suggesting, which I think makes perfect sense, and this was shown in a leak of a, whether it's true or not, of a case that came out, which showed the lock screen. His view is, on the lock screen, you'll see a full-size image. So your background image or whatever you've got on your lock screen will go across the whole phone, and it will go into the horns. It will go into the notches.
Yeah.
So you, and the shot I saw of this case, it was like an adventure-type case, you know, an outdoor case. It was gorgeous. It looked stunning. I mean, the picture looked amazing. It went all across the screen. It went to the edges, and it obviously went into the notch space. So his suggestion is that when you pick up the phone, whether it comes on automatically or whatever, when you see that lock screen, that is, you can identify that immediately as the iPhone Pro, whatever it's going to be called. And therefore, that icon makes sense because that icon is used in the Apple Pay part of the phone, which just it just makes perfect sense. I mean, you could imagine when you do the double tap or whatever you do to bring up the credit cards, that could be a full screen image as well. But then what he's saying is when you go into the apps, either apps will be forced to use the hidden status bar, which I'm just going to call the hidden status bar, which doesn't make sense because it sounds like it wouldn't be visible, but it is visible, but you know what I mean, the hidden notch bar, or there'll be a choice to use that. And there's two things about that. One that bothers me greatly, which I've been... I'm not probably muted by a few people annoying on Twitter because I've been
going
you're going
on about landscape.
Yes, it's the
if we come, yes. if we come back to landscape in a second, because I just want to unpick some of the stuff there because I have thoughts on landscape as well, but that's a bigger topic.
Okay,
I definitely agree that the lock screen is going to show the full page thing because also it's going to look even bigger then, and I think a lot of apps will display the notch quite proudly. Because if you're already doing it on the lock screen, then you may as well do it in other places as well. Like, for example, some of the apps like maybe Music, which is a very, you know, a white UI, I could see that just having the notch.
Photos.
The notch doesn't really matter that much anyway. Photos, you're going to want to use all that screen space, so you might show it all. And as a developer, I mean, you can... The status bar is... You've got three choices with that currently, as it stands. One, it can be black text on whatever color background you want. Two, it can be white text on whatever background you want. Or three, it can be not visible at all and you can use that space for whatever you want. So if you're playing a game, for example, you generally don't show that information at the top. You use the full screen. Or if you've got a photo app, sometimes they don't. But in other apps like Facebook, for example, it's going to be white on top of blue. And they'll generally show it. And generally, you always want to show the status bar because it's useful information like showing location services, Bluetooth, battery, your cellular strength, time. So it's normally you don't want to hide that unless you've got a very good reason. The other thing that it's used for, though, is that little arrow hack that they put in. So if you go from an app to another app, you can press back to whatever it might be. So if you go to Safari and it automatically opens up Amazon's app, in the Amazon app, your cellular thing's replaced with back to Amazon. Sorry, back to Safari, which you can tap to then go back. So that must stay the same, I'm sure. Odd to get rid of that. And then, I forget, but I mean, I see for developers, it would be a case of it would work exactly the same as it does now. That you can have it white on black, in which case it's going to make it look very nice because then you just have all the portion below and it's going to be seamless. You can have it black on whatever color you want and, you know, just embrace that, whatever we're calling it, the horns. Or you can get rid of it completely and just have the full horns. Or I guess there's a third way, which is what I'm going to suggest will happen in landscape mode. I reckon when you turn it into landscape, you don't get a choice. That's going to be blacked out. There'll be nothing in it. It'll just be blacked out.
Exactly.
Because that's what happens. If you rotate your phone now, like if you're in the Mail app, for example, normally, vertically, you see everything, the status bar at the top. When you put it sideways, the status bar disappears because it doesn't, you know, it's too much space because you're constrained height-wise, especially if you're using the keyboard as well. So there's already a precedent for in landscape mode, you don't get any of that information. So... You just block it off and it shrinks down a bit because they're long past the point of caring about having, you know, specific sizes and notches and things because you've got auto layout. So the design will be fine with it. But I think it'll just black out. It's a fairly easy fix.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say with landscape. And the other thing that's really frustrated me. So there's two things. One is all the damn concepts we've seen are portrait and And then what happens is they start sort of guessing as to what's going to happen with layouts and buttons. So one of the theories is about, because iOS 11 now introduces this sort of big title in settings and some of the apps, mail app, whatever, you get that sort of big title in the top left. That doesn't fit with the whole horn arrangement and the back buttons and everything. So one of the concepts that came up with, which is just ridiculous, is having the navigation, the top navigation buttons at the bottom. So they're at the bottom of the phone, either side of the virtual home button or whatever is going to be there. Which
you know,
makes
I quite
no
like
sense.
That.
Well, I like the idea in terms of access, but user interface-wise and UX-wise, it makes no sense with, A, what happens in landscape. So when you go into landscape, do the buttons stay on the bottom half of the screen or do they go to the top half of the screen? Yep. And secondly, it's a completely different user experience to an iPad. Now, I know that these are different devices and there's going to be different designs. And, you know, we're looking at iPad Pros at the moment that still have the home button and potentially a phone that's not going to have a home button. So there's always these weird differences. But the certain patterns of the OS that are consistent. And one of them is, you know, you have your nav bar at the top of the screen and your title at the top of the screen. So I don't understand how you would... It doesn't make sense to me that you would have an operating system that on a handheld device, your navigation buttons will be at the bottom. And on older devices, it would be at the top. And on iPads, which are current devices, it would be at the top. That just doesn't, I don't get that. So I think the navigation will stay at I think you'll end up with back buttons still at the top as they are now. I think maybe you'll have a sort of customizable row of things at the bottom, possibly. You know, maybe that home, virtual home button. They're talking about this sort of, not action bar, but you know what, you know, the some sort of bar at the bottom that you can add additional functions to, just like Android has had. And obviously loads of people will say, oh, Android's had that for years. You know, the sort of virtual strip at the bottom. I could imagine that. So I could imagine maybe edit buttons or other buttons like that would be located at the bottom. But I don't believe that the navigation will move to the bottom because I just think it would look, I think it would look ridiculous. But I totally agree with the, excuse me, the landscape thing. And I think more of these designs, you know, if you're going to take this seriously and you want to do one of these designs as a serious person to say, this is what I think it's going to look like, you have to take an app like, you know, calendar, maps, mail, whatever, and just take that portrait design you've done and go, right, what's that going to work like? What's going to look like in landscape? Because it's immediately going to find the flaw and the hole in your portrait design because it has to be a smooth transition.
Playing devil's advocate here. I don't think I've ever used my phone in landscape mode for anything
absolutely,
other than a game.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I've said that, and I've said that when I was tweeting about this. Someone said, oh, who uses landscape? And it's like, I actually don't use landscape that often at all. I mean, I am literally one of these people that, you know, and it's interesting because things like Facebook, I know you're not on Facebook, but things like Facebook have started doing videos and adverts that are square, that aren't landscape, that are much more oriented towards holding it in portrait mode because I think the statistics that... There are statistics out there that talk about this, but you know, it's why a lot of people take portrait photos, portrait videos. They watch stuff. I mean, you know, I've actually watched a video on Twitter or whatever that is a landscape formatted video, and I'm sitting there watching it in portrait. You know, even with a black, even the top and the bottom of the screen are black, and the video is in the middle. I'm still holding the damn phone in portrait. It's just
it's a pain to rotate it, especially if you're doing it with one hand, like if you're doing something with your other one, like if you're like for example. I mean, you know, I say that and everyone's going to have a dirty thought about what you'd be doing with the other hand. I'm thinking more like if you're eating your lunch or if you've got your hand on like a rail above you when you're on the tube and you're using your phone, you don't want to then have to awkwardly turn it round sideways in one hand.
Yeah, you haven't got as good grip. Yeah. You haven't got as good grip because you're holding it in a different way. It's much easier to knock out of your hand, to, you know, whatever. So, yeah, I mean, I don't use it that much in landscape, like you say, for gaming, for watching maybe a film or a video. Occasionally,
I'm watching Netflix or something.
Yeah, exactly. For stuff like that, obviously you're going to do it. But I don't believe that Apple are going to suddenly go, "This is a portrait only operating system from now on this device," just because we've got these notches. So I think, like you, they'll go with that mode that as soon as you turn it sideways, the notches go black, and you're just working with a slightly smaller screen in landscape. And that makes sense.
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting to see. I mean, like, so much is leaked from this HomePod thing, so we know various bits and pieces. But remarkably, bearing in mind this is all software, we don't actually have the software for how it's going to look and run. Because I don't think Steve What's-His-Face has got, like, a simulator running with it all you know, working to show what the apps actually look like, because that would be, once that happens, that would be an epic leak. Because I guess the stuff in the HomePod stuff is all stuff that is relevant to the HomePod in some ways. Like the icon is there because presumably there's some sort of iTunes service or something that you can set up the HomePod or pair it, and so it's going to have that icon for some reason. And then other stuff like the fact that there'll be a 4K Apple TV or a cellular Apple Watch is more just headers of, you know, other core libraries that are shared across the place that are in there. But there isn't, for example, a full iOS 11 version of the calendar app running in a simulator in that firmware. So we don't have any clue of how it's actually going to look, which is the most exciting bit. And that's always the way with the iPhone, because the hardware is normally always known in advance, because there's only so much you can do. There's leaks, so you hear about the stuff all the time, like the bezels or how the camera's going to improve, or that there's going to be some laser face detection stuff. But the software's all in Cupertino, and so you have no idea what's going to come, because it doesn't generally leak. And even in this massive leak of huge proportions, that stuff still hasn't actually leaked. So it's still going to be a massive surprise on the day as to how it all actually works.
Yeah, and I know that there still hasn't been, as far as I'm aware, no mention from I think it's Steve Troughton Smith, I think his name is, isn't it? There's no mention from him about Touch ID. It sounds like Touch ID is not there. However, you know, do they... Well, they obviously do, because they're releasing iOS 11 betas now that, you know, are not revealing specific things that might be coming up as features of the phone. So maybe that stuff is, you know, held back and then added in later builds. So maybe there is Touch ID still to come in some way, you know, whether it's a button on the back or whatever. Because it strikes me, but it's very Apple-like to do this, obviously. It's like having the virtual home button, and then they've still got devices with a physical home button. And, you know, even on our phones now, we've got a... People are calling it a virtual home button, you know, but it's the whatever you call it. The I can't even remember the damn word.
Taptic.
The taptic home button.
Sorry, haptic.
Haptic. Yeah.
Jesus.
Haptic home button compared to the physical home button on the iPad. So they're all for having these weird differences. So it would not surprise me if there's no Touch ID, and they're, you know, it's basically, well, you know, there's Touch ID on the MacBook Pro, there's Touch ID on other iPads and other devices, but it's just not on this one. And it wouldn't surprise me. I think it would be a shame, because I do like Touch ID.
As long as it's replaced by something that works better, then I don't give a shit if it's there or not. I really don't care about Touch ID. I mean, I like it. It works well, but like I discussed last time, I have so many problems with it not working well. Like if you just wash your hands or something, it's like, ugh. And because of the changes in iOS 10 that messed up the lock screen, so, you know, you can't just... Like, I know I've got a wet thumb and I know it's not going to read it, so I want to swipe and just type in my number. But won't let me do that. It's like, no, you've got to fail the Touch ID first. So it's not a perfect system. And if they have this laser facial recognition stuff and that works faster than Touch ID or the same speed and is more reliable, then I have no problem with it at all. I'd very happily change it. I had an interesting discussion with someone, though, who knows a bit more about this kind of stuff. And he thinks that there must be Touch ID because a lot of the banks, their contracts with Apple regarding Apple Pay will mandate a fingerprint. Like, you can't just say, oh, yeah, we're going to use a different biometric. I mean, they could, and they could force it. And, you know, some banks might not be supported at launch, but then that would be a step back, and I don't see Apple doing that. So once he said that, I was like, oh, yeah, there's going to be Touch ID. Or he's wrong, and the contracts are vague enough that they are allowed to do it that way around. But that could be something that stops this process, or at least puts another a fly in the ointment.
Well, I'll still log that theory I've got, which I mentioned a few weeks ago or a few episodes ago, which, whether it's possible or impractical or whatever, that I would say that would be quite cool if you could actually touch the camera, and that's a Touch ID. But that would take probably some pretty clever tech.
To be honest, I mean, everyone focuses on this whole, you know, Touch ID on the back and how impractical it is and how they don't want that and how the Pixel has it and blah, 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 blah. And there's two things about that. One, they're right. A home button on the back of the phone would suck. But two, it's not a home button on the back. It's just Touch ID, and you only need Touch ID when making payments.
Exactly.
So you hold the phone normally, or if it's lying down, it even said in the firmware that got released, that you'll be able to unlock your phone without having to touch the back at all, or not even lifting the phone up. You can just look at it and it'll open. But if you want to make a payment, then you're already holding your phone and you just tap the fingerprint. It's not a huge problem to do
No,
that.
exactly.
And it'll still be as reliable and it's just on the back of the phone. I can see that happening because the problem with doing it in the camera, like you say, is do you really want to put your smudgy little fingerprint over your
That's
camera
the problem.
lens?
Yeah, that's the problem. Yeah. Well, wasn't that? I was listening to an older Gruber podcast today. It was from July, so it was before all the leaks. And they were talking about there's a Galaxy. I'm not sure if it's the S8 or there's some phone that has the touch sensor near the camera. I think Rennie
Yeah, and it
Ritchie was
just.
on the show, and he was saying it's so close to the camera that what happens is you touch the camera more times than you touch the sensor, and then they've actually got software in the device to say your camera's mucky. Your camera's mucky, clean your camera. So it's like it's you can imagine these discussions. It's like, right, we're going to put it on the back. Well, you've put it too close to the camera. I keep pressing the camera. What do we do? Should we move it? No, let's put some software in to tell them to clean their camera.
That's amazing.
I love
Well,
that.
the Android ones used to be that you had to like stroke the fingerprint reader, didn't you? It wasn't like you put your
Yes.
finger on it and it unlocked. You literally had to like swipe down over it quite a few
Well,
times to get it to
that
work.
was the old Vios. I mean, literally on the desk next to me is my wife's Vio that she's still got her Sony Vio laptop, and they had fingerprint for, long, long time ago. But it was crap because it was this little tiny slot just under the trackpad, and you literally, it was like you were trying. It looked like you were trying to sort of cord start a mower or something. You're sort of just rubbing your hand over this bloody thing 10 times and finally typed in, But the interesting thing, like you say, with Touch ID, I would kind of miss it if it wasn't there. But actually, same thing with this portrait landscape thing. There's still plenty of times a day I just instinctively. I tap, well, with the phone, it's a lot easier, but obviously, because if Touch ID works, as you press the home button, it just works. But on iPads, especially, I'm always typing the damn code in. Mainly because every time I go through the damn fingerprint stuff, I don't know what happens when my fingers change or something. But, every time I try and unlock an iPad or whatever, it ends up shaking and I have to do it manually or redo the Touch ID or something. So it isn't perfect.
Thing that happens to us is that we have an old iPad Air, the original one, which my wife uses because I've got the large iPad Pro, and she's got the iPhone 6s, and I've got the iPhone 7 Plus. And when either of us picks up that iPad Air, we both try and unlock it with our fingerprint, and then go, "Oh," realize it's not got Touch ID in it, so it never works.
Oh yeah, just yeah. It's very. It'll be interesting. I'd like. There's lots of things in there about camera modes and things that have been detected as if the face recognition and the face detection can, pick up not only the normal sort of, box around the faces, but also know what you're taking a photo of in real time, so it can adjust things, which sounds interesting. And I think that's the sort of thing.
Yeah.
It's that sort of stuff that when you see that stuff listed, is human, is landscape, is, whatever. It all looks very matter of fact. I think when you see a demo of it, that's going to be the impressive thing. It's going to be like, oh, okay, now we get it. This is
Yeah, I
how
mean
this
it's
works.
just like the hardware with the camera, and it's like, okay, they're sticking a 6 megapixel camera in, and you go, "Ah, well, that's not great." And then they come on stage and they go, "Look what we've done with software that makes this camera look way better than any other camera you've used."
Yeah.
Like it handily beats an 8 megapixel. I don't know the exact megapixel counts, but that always happens. You always get a leak about the camera, and everyone always goes, "Oh, it's a shit camera compared to this." And then the software is what makes the difference.
Yeah.
And that's going to be exactly the same with everything else. I mean,
And
it's
they've
the
got
same with this unlock
the depth
thing.
sensing thing, haven't they?
Yeah, like this whole laser face recognition thing sounds incredible to me. And if they have one on the back as well, so that the augmented reality stuff can be even better than it already is, or so that they can do more impressive depth mapping for the two cameras and do the portrait mode even better because they can detect much more than 9 levels of depth, then it's going to be some very impressive stuff. But
That's the
again, it's
interesting
just
thing.
all software.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing to me because it's like the depth stuff gets talked about, but it's like if that depth stuff is really, really good, then obviously portrait mode, from what I've seen, I haven't experienced it, but from what I've seen is amazing. It's really good. It's very clever how it works. It's not perfect in some cases, but it's really good. Then obviously that depth thing make a huge difference. But I think it's this AR thing that's sort of bubbling along underneath with people doing demos and playing around with it. And it's like, it strikes me that this is the device that they're going to make that play with. And so the stuff for, you know, even when you see the AR demos now on existing hardware, it's pretty impressive. It's very impressive. You know, some of the ones I've seen.
What do you think about some sort of augmented reality goggles? Like, I think we've discussed this a little bit, but
we have.
If this camera has, if this one is all singing and all dancing and has like much better detection, because like AR kit is just a thing you use to make apps, and obviously if the hardware's better, there's no reason why AR kit can't be more accurate. So for example, these demos we see, they look good, but you get a little bit of movement, not much. I mean, it really is incredible how accurate it is.
It is amazing.
But if you have it with this laser thing so it can augment that and make it much, much better, I wouldn't be surprised if they release some kind of add-on, kind of like the VR, the Samsung goggle thing that you put your phone in and you strap it to your face to have experiences. It wouldn't shock me if they did something like that, but only for this phone. But
exactly.
Like a $200 accessory or something.
I think we've mentioned this before, but I think that could be the play. I think, you know, I know there's theories that, you know, people have said, oh, Apple wouldn't do that. They'd want to create a new type of device with a new OS that is geared towards that device, you know, like the Apple TV and all these, you know, so you don't plug your iPhone into a box that makes Apple TV work. It's a separate device called Apple TV, and HomePod the same. You know, you don't plug your iPhone with all that tech and software into an existing thing that makes it a big quality speaker. You have a separate system. So the theory is they'll have a separate device, which is these goggles, which will run, you know, iOS VR or whatever it is, and that will be an operating system specific with a user interface specific for that platform, whatever. But I think what you just said is exactly right. My feeling is that they could take that new device, come up with a really cool looking but probably expensive version of Google Cardboard, slot that device in. You know, it works a bit like the Daydream, because the Daydream is really good. I mean, the quality is not great, because that's just because the screen resolution. But it's the way it works is great. It's got an NFC thing in there, and you plug it in, it immediately knows it's in Daydream mode. The Pixel switches to that mode. And it's a $50 or £50 accessory, 70 quid or something. And you get a nice little experience. But I think that's VR, obviously. But I think the AR experience could be really interesting, especially if that's the play they're going for with that device. Because, you know, obviously, to experience AR, you have to, you know, at the moment, pick up this stuff and walk around with it. But being able to plug an iPhone into something you can then stick on your face and then play a, you know,
makes
VR
it a lot
game,
more immersive.
That would be amazing. That would be really, really amazing. So I'm not sure.
To the argument of having it all built in and being like, well, it'll be its own thing with its own OS and blah, 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 is CarPlay. Like, with CarPlay, you plug your phone in and then
that's true.
You have a whole second screen experience with a different UI, different expectations. To me, this is a visual module that you stick on. So it would work the same in that you know, once the phone detects it's in that case on your face, then it's going to be like, okay, well, now we're using the VR or the AR interface. And so there might be some way for you to, you know, there might be a button on the side or something to let you choose between certain apps that support this feature. Because you're not going to want to have like your whole home screen there or anything. It's just going to show you the ones that actually work, just like CarPlay does. So there'll probably be like a little wheel or a trackpad or something to let you scroll through the various apps, press the button, and then you can start the experience, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And there might just be a couple of actual hardware buttons or trackpads or gestures or whatever it might be to get it to work. But I can see that happening, and I hope it does, because I would love to try some of these AR things. You know, all of these demos look really, really cool, and I think people are going to be a little bit deflated when they see them in real life, because when you watch it on a screen, all you're seeing is everything from the perspective of the AR. You're not seeing the surroundings. You're just seeing what the phone is seeing. But in the real world, that's not how it looks. So when you hold your phone up and you've got like something there physically, it looks cool, but if it's bigger than the phone, like if you've got like that Aha music video where there's the guy dancing in the middle of the room.
Yes.
Well, if you're a bit close to him, you're not going to see above him or below him, and so it's going to kill the illusion immediately. The illusion's dead. Yeah. So you need to have something like that attached to right to your face and be the only thing you see.
But yeah, exactly.
I don't know how feasible that is or whether that'll come much, much later. But I really, really hope that that comes soon. Yeah, that would be amazing.
The other thing is how you frame it, in the sense that, you know, having something like, you know, if you're not going to walk around, well, you can't anyway because it's VR, but you know what I mean. You're not going to walk around with something like as big and silly as the Daydream on your face. You know, something, you're going to look like a complete twat, basically.
I've seen people on the tube, like with the Galaxy VR headset.
I've seen photos of that, but AR-wise, you're obviously wearing something that you can still walk around with and see things with. So it's whether you go down that route of saying, okay, we've built this thing for AR, and it's going to let you play games and stuff, but we're not, you know, obviously you're going to play with it at home or somewhere else. You're not going to be walking down the street with it on, but you could if you wanted to. Or whether you go down that route of creating a device more like the Google Glass, but obviously a lot better, that doesn't look as twatty, that it is going to make it more seamless and could have prescription lenses and could. But then obviously you're talking about a separate device.
I think stage one is the box on the face. On the face has two advantages, because you can then target two types of application. You could do AR, because if you put a cutout for the cameras to go through, or even augment it with another camera if you want to start charging silly money for it, then from that point of view, you can do augmented reality, so you can see straight through it as if you're wearing glasses, but obviously it's more just for experiences at home. But then an app could choose to not show the live video and just be a VR experience. And then you could do both on the same headset. Whereas with the glasses, you can only do augmented reality. You can't do anything else. But obviously that's a lot further away. You need battery. It needs to not look wanky like Google Glass.
Exactly.
There's all kinds of issues. That's not going to happen for a while, I don't think. But I could see them doing the box on the face. I want the box on the face. I'd probably pay up to £300, which means they'll charge £350 for it, which means I'll probably pay that.
Same here.
It's going to be an expensive month next month, isn't it? Jesus.
I know.
I mean, they're going to be... Oh, you've got the iPhone.
If the Pro is like probably £1,200 or something, you know, that's going to be interesting. It's got to be around that sort of price, isn't it? Because I think the high end plus, gotcha. it's like 999 or something, or
$969, $799.
It's got to be at least £1,200, at least.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if it's more, like $1,300, $1,400. And then there's going to be new watches as well. One imagines, or certainly seems based on the leaks, and it looks like they'll have cellular LTE, no voice. Another SIM card and another phone package, but a data only SIM card embedded in it, which would be nice. Although one does wonder about the battery implications of such a thing.
Apparently, the stuff that I read today was exactly that it's going to be no voice, but by having no voice means it doesn't have to have the 3G element, doesn't have to have the 3G chipset. So it's just an LTE chipset, which can reduce space apparently, and I don't know if that has an effect on battery life. I remember when I had that Plus that time, I had a 6 Plus, never bought a Plus for the 7, but I had a 6 Plus for air quotes testing, but it did come in handy for spares, which was quite good when my other phones, both our phones broke. I remember getting that, and I think I restored. I think I set it up as a sort of new device, just for testing, and I turned off the 3G chipset. I just had it on Wi-Fi, and about a week later, I came back to it on my desk, and it still had power, still had like 20% or something. And it's like the 3G chipset just kills these devices. You know, the cellular is a terrible, terrible.
It's because you're constantly having to
ping nearby
to try and find the towers. So I can see it. I can certainly see it coming. I mean, it's more, I think, a question of carrier support, because it's likely going to be one of these Apple SIMs where it's, you know, soldered into it rather than something you swap in and out.
Exactly.
And that means you're going to need to have some kind of carrier arrangement with Apple in order to make it all work. And that's where it gets tricky, because I'm not switching carrier to make that work. I wish it was... You remember back on the original iPhone, when you bought it, you literally go to the Apple store, you pay for it. There was no contract. You just had to pay the 350 quid or whatever it was and buy it.
Yeah.
And then you go home, plug it into iTunes, and then iTunes is like, hey, let's get you set up with an O2 contract. Because it had an O2 SIM card just pre-installed in it. But it had no contract. You had to buy it through iTunes, which was amazing. You're literally like, yes, I'll have contract number two. And then it would like do the credit check, and God knows what would happen if you failed. And then you just had a Wi-Fi-only device. and then off you went, and you just did it all at home. And it was such a big deal, because at the time, I mean, I always used to have to go to like Phones for You or some shit to go and get a phone.
Exactly.
And then, you know, or the hard sell and spend half an hour setting up the contracts and all the rest of it. So to go home and be able to do it in like 2 minutes just on iTunes was incredible. But then they dropped all of that, because obviously they opened it up to more carriers, and then they started doing subsidized plans and stuff. But I guess this falls back to that. I've not tried one of the iPads with an Apple SIM, because I've never bought one.
Oh, they're brilliant. Yeah,
I've never bought an iPad with a SIM card, because I've never needed one. But how does that process work at the moment? Because that's the bit I don't understand, is like, on my iPhone, I have a 3 contract. Oh, no, it's not. Wait, it's a contract. It's a 30-day rolling SIM-only contract, because I always buy the phones outright.
I think that's what I've got.
I never do the contract. So I have that, and I'm not sure what then happens with like these iPads and stuff when you get plans for those. And then, because depending on how that works, it's probably indicative of how the Apple Watch is going to work.
Yeah, so basically you go into settings, you have mobile data, and then you have an option that says set up mobile data. You click on that, and you get a varying interface, because obviously they've allowed people to put custom interfaces in for things like signing up to different services. So if I go in, I get mobile data account, and I get like a little native pop-up that comes up that says EE, always online, GigaSky, TruePhone. If I select EE, then what happens is you're almost going then into sort of a, well, you go into a subscreen that sort of has a title and has some imagery in terms of, you know, their banner logo. And then you'll get available data plans. And then as soon as you hit that, it's now saying loading. And I'm sort of going into what effectively is a web view at this point within that pop-up. Yeah. So now I'm in a web interface. And then that's when the experience gets shitty, because it's just horrific.
So it's mostly like connecting to a Wi-Fi network at like an airport.
Exactly. So then, so now you pick. Exactly. So now you pick a plan, you pick buy, and now you go to a really shitty form with horrible drop downs that's obviously based. And it's just horrific. But
nice.
When it works, it's really cool. And it basically stops, and you suddenly see the iPad. I'm on Wi-Fi at the moment, so obviously I'm not seeing it. But you see the signal, and you see like 3G or whatever, and it will suddenly disappear, reappear, and suddenly comes up with that, you know, EE or whatever. And there's no turning off the device that we used to have to do with dicking around with carriers and SIMs and things. It's all just works, and you're online, done. And it's so seamless in terms, apart from that shitty user experience, that when I had my, because now the two iPad Pros have the Apple SIMs built in, but previously it was only the 9.7 Apple Pro had the Apple SIM built in, which I either didn't know or forgot about. I just assumed that, because Apple SIM, you know, you can go and buy an Apple SIM for £5 or whatever from the Apple Store. So when they say Apple SIM, you just think, oh, it's the SIM card's in there. And I remember when I got one of those silly, I had a suitcase, I was traveling, I think I mentioned this before, and a little bead, like a little plastic bead that was for some reason in the suitcase. I think it was in, I don't even know why it was in there.
The little silicon pack type.
Yes, and it had come out, and it literally got stuck in the headphone socket and blocked the headphone socket, and that was it. I couldn't use the headphone socket, and I ended up sending the iPad to get repaired, and it got replaced or whatever. But when I was packaging it up, I obviously thought, oh, shit, I better take the SIM out. And that was the moment I realized it had an embedded SIM, because I opened it, it was like, hold on. No damn SIM card, but I've used this with data. How does that work? And so I then went through the mobile data setup, but obviously didn't buy anything, and realized that it was built in. So it's, you know, if the experience is good, it should be pretty interesting, because, yeah, I mean,
so
you could obviously...
How does it work, like, because is the reason for this so that if you go to America for, say, 2 weeks... Can you just go and buy native American data there? Like, you can just go, yeah, I want to go with AT&T for 2 weeks.
Well, it depends.
Does it work
who comes
like
up
that,
in,
or does it?
No, it depends who comes up in that list. So when you're traveling, depending on who's available in that area, you'll see a different list of providers. So I might not see TruePhone when I'm in Italy or something, or in Ireland, I might only see GigaSky and Always On. So you're seeing the providers that are local to you in that area at that time that you can use and sign up for. I don't think it works, because I was
you can just use any country's, like, well, not any country, but I mean, if I was to go to America with one of these iPads, I would be able to buy data with some service in order to use it. It's not like when you buy an iPad here and you put a O2 SIM card in, and then when you get to America, you've got roaming charges, or you have to go and buy a local SIM card and swap it out. It's like literally switch between the two.
Yeah, but what will happen is I would have to go to America and say, right, I'm in America, I go to mobile data, my UK plan of whatever I've had isn't working here or might not work here. You know, sometimes they do because it's prepaid, so they don't care. It's just going to, you know, you're just going to either pay roaming or whatever. Your usage, your data usage is going to be, you know, your money's going to reduce basically. But what can happen sometimes is that if I've signed up to GigaSky in Ireland, then I've signed up for GigaSky Ireland. That's not going to work in the UK. I'd have to go in and do GigaSky UK. So I'd have to probably go through the setup again. But yes, you can do it. And obviously, you can also plug a SIM in. But it's interesting. I always thought, I mean, it just never clicked that I thought SIM cards, you know, were tied to specific networks or whatever. Or they are in that sense. But it's the GSM standard. So it's the SIM card itself. It's the billing information that they need on there, you know, to assign it to you. Because apparently all GSM SIM cards, regardless of whether you've got a contract, must be allowed to make emergency calls. So, you know, the SIM card can make an emergency call even if it's not tied to any, you know, or sorry, no, not even the SIM card, the device. So you can take a SIM card out of an iPhone. So you've got no SIM card at all, and you can still make an emergency call on the GSM network. That's a standard across all phones, apparently. They have to be able to do that.
Hmm.
And it's a feature of the GSM network. The SIM card is literally only there to attribute you to a service. And that's why they can change it through software, which is, I always thought it was like a, you know, hard-coded physical thing on the SIM card, can't be changed.
Yeah, but it turns out it was as well.
Yeah, it's not that at all. And that's why the Apple SIM card could be fluid like that, which is really clever. And I love the fact that it can do it in real time without any turning off the device or going into airplane mode and going off again. And, you know, I just wish things like hotspots could be, these hotspot things you buy could be as good. I mean, I bought this thing that was a, what the hell was it? Linksys or something. It's a router. I used it for camping, and I've got it in our London place because we haven't got that rented out at the moment. I'm getting some work done. I just wanted some security there. So I bought one of these things, and it's basically a router that can work as a normal Wi-Fi router that you can plug a cable into, but you can also have a SIM card in it. And then it's on EE. It doesn't have to be, but I bought an EE SIM card. And then once it's connected, you've got a Wi-Fi hotspot that's running off 4G or whatever. But the setup process is just bloody horrific. I mean, it's worse than the data, much worse than the data process on the iPad. Firstly, most of the time, it only lets you do it when you're connected to that router. So, for instance, if I wanted to top up that SIM card now, if I wanted to top up that data plan, I would have to be in the vicinity of that router to connect to it for the app to then recognize that that's the account that I want to top up. You know, whereas when I added it to the EE app, I'm expecting it to appear in the EE app, and I can access that from anywhere. So I could be here and go, I want to put another 20 quid on that SIM card. And I can't. The only way to do it is to phone them up, give them the telephone number of that SIM card so that they can then add the stuff manually. It's just a horrific process. And every time when we were camping, we ran out of data. Yeah, we kept running out of data because we were just doing stuff and downloading stuff. The sort of refilling process was horrific. I had to phone up each time because I couldn't use the app to do it because it wouldn't let me connect. You know how these SIM cards will if they've got no data on them, they usually would still let you connect to like three or whatever. You could still surf
so you
to
can buy
website
more.
And top them up. Well, this didn't. This basically didn't. So I was always stuck. I could never top it up through the app or connecting via the website or whatever. Because, you know, you sort of connect up, go to Google, it redirects you somewhere, and then you know, buy more data. It would never work. So I had to phone up every time. It was just so daily, I was pretty much phoning up, going, can I add another 10 quid, or another 20 quid, or whatever. It was so frustrating.
So I mean, how much does the data cost, like, at the moment, if you try and use EE or someone?
Like, it's not great. I mean, let me have a look on here. When I was using EE with the mobile router, it was costing me something like, I think 10 gig or 12 gig was 30 quid. Which is quite a lot.
Yeah, it's quite a lot. Because that's my thing with this whole cellular Apple Watch, is in an ideal world, it would come out of your phone allowance. It's linked to my phone and uses, like, somehow the SIMs are joined. So it's like, oh, okay, you're using that SIM card, but you're just using it on a different device temporarily or something. Because I have unlimited data and I don't want to have to pay, you know, if I was going to use the Apple Watch with a cellular connection, you might use it when you go out for a run or something, so you can just take your watch, stick the AirPods in, and you can stream Apple Music or get map directions or do whatever you need to do without having your phone around. That sounds great in theory, but I don't want to have to pay £30 a month in order to get that.
And yeah, so, and also,
I don't know how that's going to work.
Everyone's going on about this, you know, commentators, whatever, going on about this. So, you know, it really frustrates me that I have to carry my phone all the time, and I want to be able to use my watch without being tethered to the phone. I'm just wondering what those situations are. I mean, yes, you could say, okay, when you go running or exercise, you don't want to have to carry the phone. But in the reality of it, these phones don't weigh as much as a brick or anything. I mean, I can run with the iPhone in my pocket, or I could carry it, or I've got an arm strap or whatever.
No.
I don't see the... For me, it's not a major number one feature that I want to be able to take my watch only out, because the only time I can imagine wanting to do that would be in a situation like that, where I've gone for a run or I've gone for a walk and I just don't want to carry the phone. In every other situation, I can't believe, you know, I don't believe I'm going to go down the shopping and not take my phone. It just is a natural thing. It's like taking your keys, you know, taking your house keys or whatever. It's the automatic thing you grab when you sort of walk out. So I don't understand it, because that one time you don't do it, you'll need your damn phone.
Yeah. It definitely seems to be more of a exercise thing. Like a lot of gyms don't like it. They won't let you like take a phone in with you. You have to leave a phone in the locker because they don't want you taking photos or whatever. I don't know. It seems a weird rule to me, but there you go. And my wife, she really wants one that, so she can go running without having the
phone. Yeah, that makes sense.
She's been using like the Run Zombies app. So I'm always saying, well, you can just take your Apple Watch, because I can load your music onto it. It's a pain in the ass, but you can just load your music on and go get a nice pair of like the Beats, the Power Beats X or whatever, so that you can go running and have good quality. But she wants to use that app, and that app can't run without the iPhone. So it's like, this is a situation where a watch that can connect to the internet would be really useful. And for me, if I go for, I mean, I don't run outside, I go on the treadmill, so it doesn't really bother me. But if I were to go running outside, I would definitely want to be able to stream my Apple Music, because I'm not going to sit and load all my music onto my watch like it's fucking 90s like an doing iTunes sync.
Exactly.
Well, we're long past the days of having to go into iTunes to sync music to the iPhone.
And I know.
I'm not going back to that just to, you know, have music on the run, because it's a pain in the ass.
Well, also, I had that with the watch where it's supposed to, you know, sync music and stuff, especially in iOS 11 and watchOS 4, it can do that more easily. But it's still a crap process. And what was happening was, even though my sort of playlists were in the, I mean, it's probably, you know, obviously because it's a beta as well, but, you know, my playlists and stuff were synced in the watch to say, okay, sync these playlists. But every time I checked the damn watch, there was no music on it. So it's like, it's supposed to be doing this when it's on the charger. And you don't want to be reliant on that. And then, you know, wake up in the morning. Because if you go in the morning and then say, oh, damn, it hasn't done it, I need to sync it. Well, you got to put it back on the charger. You got to wait for 20 minutes for it to bloody try and... Because I don't know what the hell it installs. When these things communicate, you know, it's like when you update the Watch OS, it feels like it should be doing it over Wi-Fi. That's what it should be doing, because it's what it seems to say. You know, make sure your watch is connected to Wi-Fi. But then it's also like, and in the vicinity of your phone. And so what worries me is most of this bloody transfer is being done over Bluetooth or something, because it's so damn slow. I mean, I know that the watch isn't super powerful, but upgrading the operating system on it is literally the most horrific experience. And
it's awful.
When I have tried syncing music, my initial feeling is this is doing it over Bluetooth, because I can't believe this could be doing it over Wi-Fi. It can't be this slow. It just can't be this slow. Over Wi-Fi. It doesn't make any sense. So it's just a horrific. What I would love is, I mean, for me, yes, I mean, it would be great if it was connected. It would be useful. Even if you're in the house and I've left my phone, you know, in the office or whatever, and gone in and having connectivity or whatever, that's guaranteed from the watch would be cool. But for me, it's just that process. It's that I would love to have like podcasts, and it's mainly podcasts because that's what I listen to running, because it distracts me because I hate running and anything with people talking, anything, you know, music doesn't, is too routine, but I can listen to a podcast, get into the podcast, and by the time I've, you know, it's half an hour's gone, which is cool. That's all I want. But it would be great if it could consistently and reliably sync that stuff, so that when I pick up the watch in the morning, it's already got the latest episodes on. I can just go and play it. The one thing that drives me nuts at the moment is and this is probably going to sound really filthy and horrid, but the jacket or the coat that I wear, the little running jacket that I wear, obviously when I go out running, it gets a little bit sweaty, you know, it gets a little bit moist. and it only gets washed every few days, so it's not washed daily. And what happens is, if there's any sort of traces of anything in the arm material, it's got like that sort of porous netting on the inside. It can react with the watch. I'm guessing that's what it is. So it can make the watch screen activate, and it can do stuff. And there's a really irritating feature, which I wish I could turn off. And so what I have to do every morning is I have to remember to put the watch in water mode so it locks the screen. Because what will happen is I'll start a podcast, and I'm listening to this podcast, and I run out the door, and something on my arm has made the screen come on. And the default view when it comes on, whether you're listening to a podcast, is it comes up with the episode name with a play button. And there's a little icon in the corner to change the speaking speed. And so I'm suddenly go out the door, and all of a sudden, whoever I'm listening to is speaking like, it's like, what the hell? And I have to go back and sort of go through. You can't just turn it off. You have to cycle through all the settings. So they go from like, blah, 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 to then I'm talking like the, you know, goes down to half mode, and then you finally get it back to normal. Then I have to put it in water mode to block the screen. And then later in the day, I'm wondering why I'm not getting notifications. It's because I'm still in water mode and I haven't turned anything off and I can't do anything. And
you're tapping your watch and it's not coming on, and you're thinking, yeah, why is the battery dead already? I didn't go for that long, I've run.
Really, really frustrating. So that's what I want to see improved, basically. But, you know, it'd be nice. The main thing is battery life. As long as it doesn't kill, as long as I'm not charging it during the day, I don't care. As long as I can get to the end of the day, which mostly I can get to the end of the day now, and I've still got like 50, 60% or something. Which is great. So that's what I want.
My wife's got an Apple Watch. She's got the Series 1 Sport Watch, and her battery just dies constantly in the afternoon. And I think we've nailed it down to, I mean, she'll do a workout and that eats a bit of it. But I think the problem is that when she drives, she has that really annoying maps feature where it taps you at each junction, which I like if I'm walking, because especially in London, because it could do sort of it does sort of like a long tap 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 if you need to turn right, and a tap 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 if you need to turn left.
Cool, I didn't know that.
And it's useful. Yeah, it's different depending on which direction you need to turn, which is great for when you're walking. Or if you're American and you're driving, it's utterly useless in the UK for driving, because if you get to a roundabout, it just goes, tap. It just goes, you need to look at your watch to tell you which way to go, which you don't want to be doing when you're driving. No. And the annoying thing about that feature is that it does not turn off automatically when it detects CarPlay. So even though my phone is plugged into CarPlay, it's still tapping my arm, so I just turn it off completely. And then I have to go and manually turn it back on if I want to actually use the feature for when I'm walking around and using it. I don't need it in the car because it's just irritating. But she loves it, and she really likes it because it sort of taps and she knows when she's got to turn and stuff, because she doesn't have CarPlay in her car. And I have a feeling that is what's absolutely crushing her battery life, because she drives to work and back every day and has it on all the time. And so it's just constantly going tap, 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 tap all the time. Fucking Morse code on her wrist. I don't know how she can't imagine driving with it. It's so irritating. Because you just think you've got notifications all the time. I'd be constantly looking at my wrist. I mean, the nice thing is when you've got CarPlay, this is the annoying thing about CarPlay. On the one hand, if you've got the Maps app and you've got that feature enabled, it taps your wrist all the time, which is terribly distracting. On the other hand, if you get a notification like a text message or something, you get no notification on your wrist at all. It only shows up on the screen. And if you don't have audio turned on your phone, which I never do, it doesn't make a noise. So you often don't see it. So quite often I'll miss messages when I'm driving, but it will keep telling me constantly that I need to turn left or right or whatever, which I already know because I'm glancing at the screen all the time to see where I'm going. Very frustrating.
I wonder what will happen with iOS 11 with driving mode. I wonder if that will stop the watch tapping.
I don't know. I'm still in mixed minds about that. I mean, it's the driving mode's interesting because it's something I've been meaning to write a blog post about for about 3 years, because it is by far the number one pitched app idea that people send to me. Hey, I've got this great idea that would improve road safety. Why don't you make it so you can't use your phone when you're driving? And I'm like, yeah, that's Okay, that's clever, but you'd have to either manually turn it on, in which case, if you've got the willpower to turn an app on to say, I'm driving, don't bother me, then, just don't use your fucking phone when it beeps when you're driving. Put it in airplane mode or something. Or if you want to do it automatically, well, how do you differentiate between if you're a passenger or you're on a train or whatever? And people always come back and they're like, oh, well, you'll just be able to cancel it if that's the case. It's like, well, why would you use the feature in the first place? Like, if you're making the feature to stop dangerous driving, but I can turn it off, then that isn't going to stop dangerous driving. That's just making you think that people should use that feature, but they won't. If someone's made the conscious effort not to drive dangerously and use an app, then they can just as easily not drive dangerously and not use the app. It's kind of, I don't understand the problem it's trying to solve. And while I
Put the
can see
watch in your
Apple,
boot.
yeah, I mean, Apple's doing a good thing by having this option, and it's going to be like, oh, hey, looks like you're driving. Should we enable driving mode? But I think most people won't bother, is my take on it, my cynical view. But I certainly won't. But I mean, I've got CarPlay, so I don't need to. But I'd be interested to
Yeah,
see how that
CarPlay will be
all
good.
plays together, because I've still not put iOS 11 on my phone because I'm not stupid. So I've
Well,
not tried this stuff yet. I've
it has got a
just
lot
been doing
better.
it
I
on the
mean,
iPad.
it has got a
I've
lot
got it on
better.
the
The
iPad,
last,
and it is better.
yeah, it's I did go through a couple of weeks of like torture because I was literally having to restart the phone a couple of times or a few times a day. But I couldn't downgrade because once you've upgraded the watch, you're screwed. If you have to send it back to Apple to downgrade it. I didn't know if the new watch OS would work with the older 10 point whatever. So I just thought I'll just stick it out. Waited for that day. You wait for the Monday and think, please let it be today. And then an update came out. And it seemed like, which I think I sort of mentioned before, not on here, but I think I've said it on Twitter. They've started. Looks like they may have gone into weekly cycles now, because we had an update this Monday, which was not on the 2 week cycle. So it looks like
It
as we're getting
tends to pick
closer.
up a bit towards the end, yeah.
Exactly, and it is very close. I mean, there's still a few little glitches. The biggest one is the missing Twitter Facebook integration because they've removed Twitter integration. Then all of the share panels fail. Because you can't share to Twitter, because it, and it, and it's still there. You go into a particular app or whatever, you say, I'll share to Twitter. It pops up with your Twitter box that you could normally type in, which you can type in, but there's no account selected. And then it comes up with an error saying, you've got no accounts, please go to settings. Well, you can't because there's no Twitter option in settings anymore. So they're still leaving it to the last minute to sort of remove or change how that's going to work.
Well, that's I can see the problem there. That's a developer issue, because if a developer has got a button that when you press presents a sheet, I mean, really it shouldn't present a sheet at all. It should probably just show an error, I guess. But there's a
No, it's
tricky problem there, because if you just remove the framework completely, and then when you press that button, it would just crash, which would not
exactly.
be ideal. But then you also don't want to have it when you press the button, nothing happens at all. But the error message you get saying, oh, go to settings, will be that's like the default error that you as a developer would write if no accounts have been set up. So, I mean, like any app I've ever done that does Twitter will be okay, if it can't find any accounts and you've not given permission when it's asked for access to your Twitter accounts, which is probably what's happening here because the authorization would never happen, then that would just be the error that you'd put because that's the obvious choice. So the developer would need to update it and remove it. Because I imagine if you put that in iOS 11, sorry, in Xcode 9, it would go, yeah, this isn't available in this. Because I don't think, and I could be wrong on this, but I don't think there's ever been a deprecation that's actually stopped something working. Like, quite often stuff in iOS gets deprecated. It's like, okay, this API is no longer available. And if you try and build with it, it just gives you a warning and it'll be like, this might go away at some point. And to my knowledge, nothing ever has. So you can still
Yeah, it
use like
sounds.
old things that you're not supposed to. Sometimes they don't work as they're intended to, but they never crash the app. Whereas if
No,
you
it
literally
sounds.
just got rid of all of that stuff, that's problematic.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, it obviously down to the developer. The interesting thing is it does it on the built-in apps like Photos as well. So it's
I
it,
found a
it...
really annoying, not a bug as such, I suppose it is, but so I'm working on an app at the moment for a client. And it's not a photo app, it doesn't do anything with photos. But there is at one point you can share an image. With like a little activity controller that pops up with all your apps and stuff that you can use to share it. So, you know, you can save it to notes or send it via iMessage or whatever. And because an image was sent to that view controller, it gives you the option for save image. So I tapped on that to save it to my camera roll. And then the app crashed because I hadn't set the privacy setting in my app bundle to be, oh, you can use it. And I was like, well, that's a little bit disingenuous because I'm not like, it's not like I've tried to access the media library myself unknowingly. It's just that their implementation does it without telling you so much. So that was a bit weird. So you have to still put that in, even if there's the off chance of, you know, getting to that via a different route, which I understand, but it would be nice if they didn't hard crash the app if you've forgotten that and they just put a default description in to say, oh, they're obviously trying to save a photo, or gave it like a one-time permission just for that. You know, you're doing it through an Apple embedded display, you should be able to save it. But I'm getting into the nitty-gritty of iOS development. Always a joy.
Yeah. The interesting thing is the Facebook one works. So from the Photos app, you can do Facebook and it will pop up with the same little action sheet thing, or the pop-up with the box that you type in, and it will let you pick who you want to share it with and everything. I posted something where it was only to me so I could test it, and it works. So that works, but Twitter doesn't.
It actually still work. See, I thought that had broken ages ago because they've made so many API changes that I tried it in an app a while ago. Because it like gives you a token back that you can use to make other... I think probably the share sheets always worked, but the bit where it gave you a token and then you could make requests to the Graph API, that stuff's all been like completely rewritten by Facebook. So if you try and do it as per like Apple documentation, it just fails miserably because none of that stuff's there anymore. It's always been a bit of a mess. I was always surprised when they added that feature. Like I kind of liked it and I used it in a few apps, but no one used it because no one knew where the settings were, and obviously people were used to going to the Facebook app to authenticate and then go back again using like their OAuth system, because you just embed their framework, and so no one ever used that settings thing and used to confuse people. You get loads of complaints about it, and so then you just have to bite the bullet and go, oh, well, it was nice to do all of this with 5 lines of code, but now I'm going to have to embed like a 200 meg fucking framework from Facebook into my app just so people can post a message, which is the reason I don't do that. I just can't be.
Yeah, I mean, it was...
So it's nice that it's like opened up to third parties properly now, so that people can, like, if you... Hopefully, the way it should work is that if you have the Facebook app installed, then you should be able to post to Facebook via their own extension in the same way that WhatsApp or Pinterest works.
Yeah, so I'm wondering whether it's a Twitter, whether maybe Facebook have done that already or something, and maybe Twitter haven't. So maybe as soon as they do that extension or whatever, that this will suddenly start working. But I guess, you know, they don't have to yet because it's not out yet. But we'll see what happens. Yeah, well, cool. It's probably a good time to finish.
Yeah, I've got some curtains coming and being put up and some more blinds, which will be fun. That's my excitement for the afternoon, making cups of tea for the curtain man.
Nice. I've got some prototyping to do, actually. I've still got some coding to do, but I've got to do some prototyping for a client of using one of these online prototype services just to knock up a few screens, show them what something's going to look like. So I better get that done.
I hate doing that stuff.
I know.
I always... we should probably talk about this another time. We should probably talk about some freelancing stuff, actually, next episode.
Yeah, yes.
we just turned into talking about iOS 9 lately. Not iOS 9, iOS 11. Jesus, I'm so tired. But prototyping, I used to hate doing it. I used to do it in Photoshop, and that was a nightmare.
Oh, God.
And I try using like all these online services where it's like, oh, drag and drop all these bits of UI, and there's always something missing that you need, and then it doesn't look right. And then they started doing these clever interactive ones where they're like little web views that do stuff, which I can't abide. And so now I just generally, I'll build an app like in storyboards in Xcode, because you can get all the standard iOS components. And then if you need something custom, you can, you know, just whack an image in or mock something up pretty easy. And I can make it work if I need to do something to show like a map or a location. And then if they're all happy with it, I can just from there, that's the project I've already started.
You're reusing it.
A head start. I just, you know, tidy up. So I've had quite a lot of success with that, and quite often, I mean, I've had projects where they haven't provided designs up front because I say, you know, maybe their designers like from a print background or something, they don't really know about iOS user. So quite often I will functionally build an app as a wireframe, so the whole thing is just done with standard components in Storyboards and Xcode, and it's a full working app, but it just looks like shit. And then their designers look at that, and then they make it pretty, and then I integrate the design afterwards, and that works quite well. But
yeah,
yeah, we should probably talk about that kind of stuff. Yeah, process.
That'd be good. I'll see that on the next one. Cool.
Yeah, unless the HomePod firmware has more interesting tidbits in it, which I'm sure it will.